Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And today we have a really great story, and I'm coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Wow, I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper John Enright because, well, he is taking us to another place, absolutely, that most of us have never had the opportunity to see. And I am so happy to welcome you, John, to Joy on Paper. And the name of your book, of course, is Pango, Pango, Tango. And it is a jungle beat mystery, and I love it.
Oh, hi, Patsy.
Hi. Well, you know, I was so thrilled when I got this book, and I was really excited to discover that you have this series with releases, one sort of one after another, so that people can really binge read.
I like that.
Yeah.
Binge reading, yes.
Yeah, I think that's a you know, people are used to that now. Whenever you know something comes on streaming video, they don't release one, you know, program at a time. They release them all so that people can binge, because people really do like to binge when they get into a character. And I think with your books, this Jungle Beat Mystery series, which is, it's such a different series and something so exciting, I think people will just be enthralled with it, and they will want to know more because it is set as in American Samoa, where most people have never been, but you write about it so well that it's sort of like becoming a tourist. You're taking a trip with your writing.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, it's a nice place to visit, even in a book.
It is. It is. So the name, as I said, the name of this first one is Pango, Pango, Tango. And, well, I think that's so great. And if nothing else, people will learn how to pronounce it.
Okay, well, actually, the pronunciation is Pango, Pango.
Pango, Pango. Okay, Pango, Pango, Tango. Okay. So, you know, you, of course, spent so many years, I think over 20 years in Samoa, and I don't think most Americans even know where it is and don't realize that it's much closer to Australia than to America.
Yeah, it's the only American territory in the Southern Hemisphere, and if you want to find it on the globe, you could draw a line from Hawaii to New Zealand, and about two-thirds of the way down into the South Pacific is Pango Pango.
So when you, I understand that your first trip to there was, you were became a teacher, right, at the college?
That's right, yeah. When I first moved there, I moved there as a as an English teacher at the American Samoa Community College.
And did you ever expect to stay there for so many years?
No, I didn't when I moved there. But it was, after 26 years, it was actually kind of hard to leave.
Well, I can imagine. So, what I like about the story is, you have to explain about your detective. I like very much that he was raised in San Francisco and comes back to the island. And so you have this sort of San Francisco vibe from him. Do you want to explain how you developed this character and how to pronounce his name? I'm not sure I will pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, his name is Detective Sergeant Apelu Soifua, and the character was born in American Samoa, and his family moved to San Francisco when he was a child, and then he grew up, went to high school, and started work as a policeman in San Francisco. And then later in his life, after about 20 years in California, he moves back to Samoa to take over his family land and responsibilities of being the new head of the family there. So he's definitely a Californian in many ways, but at the same time, he's very much a Samoan. He's 100% Samoan. So part of the purpose of the book, actually, is to show the difference between American worldview and culture and Samoan worldview and culture, and sort of introduce Americans to their Southern Hemisphere fellow citizens.
And with this story, really, you bring an awareness to Samoa and to what's happened over the years. Now, America took over the island, I think, a long time ago, 1907, was it?
1900. Was when it was. And American Samoa was sort of, those islands were sort of ceded to the United States through a treaty that the Samoans had nothing to say about. And Germany took part of the archipelago, and America took the other part.
And then, of course, nearby we have the French Polynesian island, right?
That's right, and then Belknap's to the east there.
So, of course, it's a small place. How many square miles is it? It's not very large.
No, I think total, that's a very good question. I think total land area of the islands is something like 80 square miles or something.
So it's...
And there's... there's a series of islands. One major island, the island of Tutuila, which is where Pongo Pongo is, and a few out, and then some outlying islands as well. But there's only, at the time that Topelu's stories take place, there's really only about 50,000 people there.
Now, if Americans know anything about it, they probably think of it as a tuna capital, where, right?
Yes, if they know that, that's pretty good. Yeah, there was two major tuna canneries there, and a lot of your tuna fish in the United States comes from Pongo Pongo.
So, one of the things that comes through this story, you have this dichotomy: the natives who want to maintain their lifestyle and their beliefs and their way of life, which is very special, and then of course you have the I guess it's not just white people, but it's white people, the Palangi, right?
Very good Palangi, yes.
Who have changed everything.
Well, it has been an American territory for over a century now, and the action in this book takes place about 25 years ago, so, or 30 years ago. So even though there's the Palangis, which means basically, actually in Samoan it means skybreaker, the outsiders only at the time made up only less than 2% of the population. But they did have the influence of the U.S. dollar, which has an impact wherever it goes. And the culture. So it's part of the purpose of the book is to show there is a friction between those two worlds.
And for Palu, he's in both worlds. After not living there as a child, what problems did he discover?
Well, I think he was, part of the problem was that the Samoa that he remembered from his childhood was not the Samoa that he returns to, which has become more Americanized, and is not as simple as it was when he was a child. So his culture clash, his culture shock is more that Samoa has changed, and he has to kind of re-enter a new place. But it's still Samoa, but he's different, and so is the place.
And then being a San Francisco detective, he works on a different level. His experience in crime is certainly in a different level. So how does he work in this new environment? How does he, with this new challenge in this first book, there's some question about, you know, if he's acting too strong as a detective, and they try to sort of hold him back.
He does have the constant problem of applying his San Francisco learned skills in Samoa and being sensitive to what's there. And I think in the books he generally does pretty well with that. He's not by any mainland measure a totally efficient cop. He lets people get by. He works inside the culture instead of against it. So that's part of his learning experience.
Tell us about this mystery in the first book, about what the basic plot is.
Oh, okay. The basic plot has to do with drugs being smuggled in and his attempts to deal with that. But he has to discover, first of all, that that is what the problem is. And part of it is dealing with the Palangis, who are somewhat responsible for the methamphetamine coming into the territory. So it's really a detective trying to discover the clues that will lead to who's responsible. So it's a pretty straight police procedural in that respect. But of course the problems are that that he's working in two different worlds. So one set of clues fits one world and another set of clues fits another world. So with that he's got to work it out. And there's a certain amount of his own private life involved in the book as well.
Well, explain that. Explain his relationships, some of his relationships in this book.
Okay, in this first book, he's still married. I'm giving away the books after this one. In the first one, he is still married to his wife, a Samoan wife, whom he met and married back in San Francisco, and he has three children. And he is a family man, but at the same time he's getting used to being in Samoa, and his wife is not quite getting there at the same time. I don't want to give the whole thing away.
Don't give more away. But that's intriguing enough, because it's always. When you sort of pick up and move your family to a new place, there's always this problem of who's going to adjust and how they're going to adjust to a new place, and particularly first of all, just being married to a policeman is difficult enough, I think, for women, because you know, in San Francisco, I'm sure, you have a sort of big worry every time they walk out the door. And perhaps when you get to Samoa, you think maybe it's not going to be so bad, but crime is everywhere.
Yeah, it's, I want to show... I wanted to show some of the, not just about the police work in Samoa, but what life was there like. So in the book, he gets out into the villages and he has friends, you know, Samoan friends that are living in the traditional way. So that there's a certain introduction to what's called the Samoa, the way of Samoa, and which... was part of my purpose in writing the book, was that I wanted to expose? I wanted to show to American readers what living in another culture was like. and especially a culture that is so fascinating as I found Samoan culture and life there.
Well, you certainly make it for the reader. There is this element of being immersed in a new culture, not something that we're familiar with, and perhaps the closest thing is recently Robert McCaw has written this series set in Hawaii, and he's also very thoughtful about the natives and about their way of life and how, and sort of honoring that, which is exactly what you're doing in your series.
Well, I hope the readers are ready for it. I hope they're interested in finding out about other places and other people. I think that's part of being a human and being a cognizant person is discovering what's different, you know, what's not like you.
And I agree. I think that definitely people, I think people will find this fascinating because you do, you know, after all of your years there and being part of the culture and being part of, you know, it's a small place, so you must have known practically everybody there. So for you, for yourself, when you first got there, was it a big cultural shock for you? Did you try to live like an expat without immersing yourself in the culture? Because I was an expat. I went to Iran, and all the Americans, they continue to be expats, but I immersed myself in the country, and I learned the language, and I learned the cooking. I learned, you know, so I got a different feel than like most of the expats who were there.
Well, first of all, most of the expats are passing through and don't stay 26 years. Are more like they're under contract or they're just moving on. They're, you know, wandering people. My job, I mean, after teaching at the college, I run an environmental education organization there. And for 13 years, I was the state historic preservation officer. So I was kind of immersed in the culture, and I married a Samoan lady. I adopted a Samoan son, and although I never became Samoan, I never could. I tried to be as non-expat as possible, and just be a citizen, be a member of the community.
Now, of course, in the book, you talk about the problems, some of the problems of in general, you know, the world goes on, and for natives or indigenous people of a place, the changes are sometimes pretty horrendous for their environment.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Samoans have been over the century and a quarter of American presence there, Samoans have been amazingly resilient in their culture, in their language, and in their practices. They have an attitude, I think, towards Palangi is just sort of like, well, they come and they go, and they never really do much, you know. And Samoans just continue as Samoans. On the other hand, there is the impact of such things as Western food and diet, which has changed Samoans a lot. There's things like pickup trucks and TV, and the, you know, the impact of American dollar everywhere. But at the same time, Samoans, I think, is especially admirable in their ability to remain themselves, to remain and be proud of being Samoan. So it's a special place that way.
And you really create a very atmospheric book that I think people will enjoy. And one of the things you mentioned there about the pollution that comes around well, any industry, but particularly in this canning business.
Yes.
Are things getting better? Are they tightening up laws and rules so that all of the reefs and everything aren't destroyed?
Yes, there has been progress that way. There has been, and part of that, we can thank the United States laws for part of that. I mean, with the EPA has, you know, moved in, and OSHA and those federal agencies have a presence there now, which helps to restrain the incoming polluters. And there has been progress, definitely. And it's still a lovely place to visit. I do want to mention, you know, the other three books in the series continue, you know, the whole theme, and that there is there'll be a fifth book coming out soon, I hope, in the same series. So,
well, I think it's
being done.
I like the idea of having them released shortly after each other, because I think, I don't know what your publicity campaign is going to be, but I think that if people get into the sort of swing of things, once you start with the first one, and this one is Pongo Pongo Tango, which is here in July, and then in August you're going to have Fire Knife Dancing, and in September The Dead Don't Dance, and then in October Blood Jungle Ballet. So people can get really get into that binge mode. I love to get into that binge mode where you read boom 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 one after another, and the characters are with you, and you feel like you're there with them, you're traveling around the island with them. I love that.
Good. Well, I hope to read the rest of it. I hope you have time to read the rest.
Well, I will. Of course I will. I definitely will. Because I just found them fascinating. I wanted to know more about Palu, and I think that, and the characters around him, and about where his life is going to take him. And I hope that there's going to be, I'm sure there'll be some more great mysteries involved. You're writing, of course. You've been writing for many years, so you're a very talented author. And you do, as I said, capture the feeling of the island, and I think readers will enjoy that.
I think so, too. I share your opinion there.
Yeah, and you must have fun with this character. I think when a character takes you over, he becomes part of your life.
I just finished the next book in the series, and you're right. It's sort of like I don't have my friends around anymore.
Yeah.
It's like Apelu's on vacation somewhere. I got to bring him back.
That's it, because once you have that joy on paper and you bring a character to life, they stay with you, and then suddenly they keep sort of nudging you and say, write some more. so that
bring me back. I think of them as cast of characters, almost like actors. You know, you bring them back on the set. Here is your scene.
Well, and mentioning cast of characters, if the rest of the books are as good as this one, and I'm sure they are, I think, again, one of the things is, you know, we do need more and diversified subjects in the streaming video world. So Hollywood, once you get finished with all your strikes and all your arguments and everything, I hope that they'll have a look at this series, because I think it's interesting. You have a wonderful character. Well, all the characters around him too are interesting, and this exotic location, which is sort of a combination of exotic and then also with the sort of business side, I can see definitely that this would make a wonderful streaming video series. So once we get through all this, I understand I was talking to a friend in Hollywood, and they said they're like crazy. They're They're all crazy right now because they're going to have another strike. But once they get over that, they need to look for new properties. So I hope we can get their attention to your writing because, you know, John, you're a terrific writer. That's just solid. You're a solid writer, and that's always my biggest compliment. When a writer is solid, you know that you're in good hands when you pick up that book, and people will be with Pongo Pongo Tango. You have a website that you want people to go to.
My the author's page is at.
JN Wright Author.com. People, you can go there, and John also has blogs. He also has more information that you can discover, but his book is available online, and definitely order it. It's a great read. You will love this character, and I like when readers start on a character and they start to say, well, he's part of my life too. Now I know all about him. So, John, you did a terrific job with this book. And perhaps what we'll do is we'll have you back in for the Blood Jungle Ballet. How about that? We'll have you back in October and we can catch up on the release of all the other books, okay?
That's terrific. Thank you, Patsy.
Okay. You take care now and keep writing. I look forward to talking to you again in October.
Okay. Nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay. We'll just do some commercials and then we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi! This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. I hope. Is she on? Okay. I am so excited to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jillian Harvey. And the name of her book is One French Summer. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well, I just love talking to you.
Thank you.
I love your accent.
Oh, this is nice.
And, of course, I love your books. I love all of your books.
Thank you.
And this one is called One French Summer. And the question is, can a holiday be the start of new beginnings? Well, we hope so. So how are you, Jillian, just as a person, not as a writer, just as a person? My guests are, you know, I always get so close to some of them, or I feel like I know them, or I feel like they're friends. And with you, I just, when I hear your voice and I think about where you are, I just feel so relaxed. So tell my guests, tell my listeners where you are right now and about your life in general before we start talking about the book.
Okay, well, I'm here in sunny Limousin in France, and all the children are off on their summer break now, so we're heading off to the lake after this to go to the beach. So it's pretty relaxing. We're trying not to do too much, and it's quite hot at the moment, but life's good.
Well, so explain to people, how did you land up in France?
I was very much on a whim, really. It's funny because my husband and I were both teachers in the UK and kind of slaves to the mortgage, and life was pretty stressful, and we just thought there must be something we can do where we can be together a bit more and where we're not sort of constantly on a treadmill. And I had some difficult days at work, a few difficult days, and when I came back, I said to him, should we just move to France? And it was completely out of the blue. But it was because partly we'd been watching a couple that everyone watches, you know, about settling in different places. But we'd never really thought about it seriously until I made that suggestion, and suddenly it just seemed right. So here we are. I mean, 13 years now that we've lived here, so it must have done something right, I think.
I mean, it's sort of like a Peter Mall, you're in Provence type of thing that
happened
to you.
Absolutely.
I mean, I love it. I think it's so... I get such a kick out of it. I think of you there every once in a while. I think of France a lot. I enjoyed it so much when my husband and I used to travel all around France, and I just the idea of you picking up from the UK. What's that other series that the British couple who pick up and move to Calais? It's just, I think it's such a wonderful thing to do.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's not something, we're not the type of people who do things like this normally. So I think we used up all of our impulsivity in one move. We just had a sudden moment, and it worked out. So we're quite lucky.
And what's your accent? Where are you from in England? I mean, because you have a different, you know, in England, everybody has a different accent.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm from Hertfordshire, which is just north of London, so...
I know the area well. I've been to St. Albans quite often.
Yeah. Oh, wow, okay. I was born in Harpenden, just near the Hesse.
Okay, well, I love St. Albans. We used to go there quite often. All around there are country houses. In the spring, they used to have, they probably still have, flower shows. Mm.
And
we used to go, we had a white Cadillac in England. So you can imagine, it was so funny. Yeah. We drive into these flower shows at, you know, at some of these great manor houses or the other, you know, sort of semi-castle-y kind of houses. And we drive in with this white Cadillac. And I would always wear something lovely because I wanted pictures. You know, I didn't want to dress in jeans. I wanted, if I was going to have a picture in a flower garden, I was wearing a dress, you know, and a hat.
Brilliant.
And so people would just stop and say, who are they? Who are they? You know, and since my husband was wearing a cowboy hat, people would come and say, are you JR? Are you JR?
That's brilliant.
I had a feeling that's where your accent came from, because you know, in England, I moved to Sonning, you know, which is near Henley, and it was you know, everybody has this different accent, and I love it. I hope that they don't destroy it and get rid of, you know, all these local accents, because I think they're terrific.
Oh, yeah, no, I think they're pretty hardwired into different areas, so I think they're safe for now, at least.
That's great, because, you know, you go to Manchester, and Kieran Kieran or Liverpool. Oh boy.
Yes.
So what, you know, you got to France, and when did you start writing? Now, are you mentioned to me something about you're writing 3 books a year now?
That's right. Yeah, it's quite an interesting thing I've agreed to do. But I mean, I always write fast, and I always like to be busy. So it suits me really, my new contract, and just seeing if I can do it really. And so far, so good.
And I mean, I like to keep busy. Oh, you have 5 kids. they didn't keep you busy enough, I guess.
No, well, it's a different kind of busy, I think. I can escape. When I write, it's like I can transport myself somewhere completely different, and that can be quite useful sometimes as well. So it's the best of both worlds, in a way.
And, of course, in this book, in the new book, it's, as I said, 1 French summer, and, again, pulling in your French knowledge and all your experiences now, and how you can, you know, blend in the story. So tell us about Katie and this story.
Okay, so Katie is someone who's been married for a long time, and she was always quite happy with her husband, or never really questioned the relationship anyway. And he asked for a break, and she's really taken by surprise. And then later on in time, she's been spending some time with her best friends, and they just kind of whisk her away to France for a retreat, kind of to heal more than anything else, to get a break from feeling low and feeling abandoned and just let go for a couple of weeks. And they're great friends, and I'm quite jealous of her for having such wonderful friends that will do this for her. And they really do learn a lot about themselves and each other, and I think all of the characters move forward in their own way because of this one holiday and what they learn there.
And so what kind of retreat do they go to? Because that's interesting for people, for readers.
Yeah, it's a painting retreat. So the story behind it is that, I mean, there's no particular preference that they have. They just want to book something last minute, but it turns out to be a painting retreat. And the lady that runs the retreat is very sort of self-assured, and she likes painting and doing it in a mindful way. And that really helps Katie to kind of get in touch with herself and start stopping and actually seeing what's around her and seeing things as they really are, I suppose. So she's learning a lot more than just about how to paint well. She's learning really how to kind of look at life in a different way during the time there.
Well, the interesting thing is there are a lot of these retreats in France, more so than I know. I mean, they're in America, but they're not as interesting. In France, you can go to a language retreat where you learn to speak French, or you can go to a like this one, art one, or you can go to a cooking one, which is very popular.
Absolutely, yeah. There's quite a few writing ones as well, and one day, I look at all these writers posting pictures from them, and I'm so jealous because there's no way I could really do that at the moment with the children and everything, but one day I'll be there in those photos sunning myself. So I suppose there's a little bit of me that was living through Katie when she went away for her holiday as well.
Well, of course, as you said, the friends and Katie, you know, Katie is somebody who, she is lucky that she has friends who are willing to take her to a retreat, because I think it does show the importance of having good friends.
Absolutely, yeah, and they're all... They're very different in their own ways. They're sort of, they come together because they work together. And so in that strange way that you bond with people maybe that you wouldn't be friends with if you'd met them in a different situation, they've got that in common. And they all balance each other out really nicely. So there's Summer who are slightly more forthright, and Ivy's quite kind of calm and thoughtful, and Vicky is the head teacher at the school they work at, so she's a bit more kind of organized and businesslike, and they gel really nicely together. They're a great group.
When you know, I don't know, It's so much fun to read your books, and you have this wonderful way of bringing in the whole sort of the milieu of where you bring your characters. And I thought with this one, I was particularly intrigued with it. I found that I was relaxing and thinking about being in France. And I think you're having lots of fun with this.
Yeah, I think I've sort of started to look where I live. I mean, I'm not quite as far south as the retreat in this particular book, but since starting to write books set in France, I've been looking at the scenery that surrounds me all the time and trying to think what makes it unique and what makes it very French, and the way people are and the way the buildings are. And I've really tried to transport the reader into the same scenery that I'm used to now. And it's interesting because I know a lot of writers who write kind of escapist books, they'll go for a holiday somewhere and so they'll see it all for the first time. And with me, I had to sort of take off my everyday glasses, I guess, and see it all as if for the first time again. And that's been really nice because it's helped me to appreciate anew where I live as well and really see it again. So it's worked well.
Now, do you live in the countryside? Do you live in a village?
Yeah, I mean, they call it a town, but I would call it a village. It's probably 2,000 inhabitants, so it's small-ish. We used to live in a very small commune, but we found it a little bit too remote. So we've come to the edge of a village stroke town where there's a bit more community and it's better for the children, obviously. There's school, nice schools here and that sort of thing. But it's a lovely place. You can't go down the street without everyone sort of saying bonjour to you and stopping to talk. And no one's ever really in a hurry, or that's how it seems, at least. So it's a lovely feel-good place.
And you have a real bakery.
Yes, three, in fact.
Yes. I was going to say.
One's never enough.
No, I know. That's what I love so much. When we used to drive around France, we'd always stay in villages. We'd always stay in small places. And just remembering the village and the bakeries and the fresh fruits and... I'm more and more aware in America of how terrible food tastes. we really have gotten so far away from natural tasting foods. And I think it's such a shame because people don't understand really what, when you are in France, and I hope that they still, you know, keep things that way, that the food is different.
They're very protective of of the patisseries here and the bakeries. They like legally, supermarkets are only allowed to, they've got certain rules about when they can sell fresh bread in supermarkets, and they're everything's sort of, I tried to open a little business when I was first here making cakes, but you have to pass so much legislation to do that, to even just kind of sell cakes on a little craft store or that sort of thing. They just protect everything so much, which works out well, I think, really, in the long run, because you've got all these lovely places and it's worth people's while running them. And yeah, they're real speciality places, which is great, not for the waistline, but for everything else.
Well, no, actually it is good for the waistline, because it is true, and they're finding more and more that one can go to France and eat the food and not gain weight. Mm. But in America, our food is so filled with chemicals that it's not good for our health. And I sort of go back to the time when I remember in England, when I first got there, one of the funniest things for me was where there would be the fruit vendor, and you didn't actually, they picked the fruit for you.
Oh, yes.
You didn't paw through it. I love it, but it was so fresh, and they picked the best one for you. So it was it was wonderful. I'm just more and more aware here of that we don't have any place that has in a small French village. The bakery there is better than anything you can find here. It's crazy.
It's a shame.
But you're very lucky. I think you've found your niche. You found the right place, and it turns out that it's been great for your kids because they're bilingual.
Oh, yes, and it's so effortless for them as well. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, isn't it funny?
Away.
Isn't it? You look at it and you say, how do French people speak French so perfectly? you start young, I guess, and that's what happens.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And well, I think you know this book and One French Summer. What other books do you have out right now? Too, you have a couple others, right? Recently.
Yeah, in fact, I've got my latest one actually came out today. It's called A Month in Provence. So that's the next one.
So people, so we can get that one too. Wow! Okay.
Yeah, it's available now. Yeah, today. Yeah.
Okay. Well, everybody, get one of Jillian Harvey's books. Get a bunch of them. This is the perfect time of the year to sit under a tree or sit by the pool. And Jillian is spelled the proper way. With a G-I-L-L-I-A-N, Jillian Harvey. She has a lovely website. You can go there, find out. I don't know how many books you've written now, set in France, but...
three in France and then two in the UK, so yeah.
Okay, well, you must be very popular in your village, as a famous writer now.
Well, I've had one book translated into French, so at least people do know that, like, they can actually read my books now, so that's quite nice.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, well, Jillian, I think you're just fun to talk to. I'm hoping maybe one day before the pandemic, I had actually planned to go to England. My son was going to go to Cambridge. To do some study there, and I was going to go to England, I was going to go to France, and of course then the pandemic hit, and it was the end of those plans.
Yeah,
but you never know.
That's a shame.
You know, I do get this. I do get this yen to be back in France and to be just really relaxed, and I could easily do a retreat near you, and then I will pop in and meet you, okay?
Well, you'd be more than welcome.
I know, because that's you know, it's wonderful when you have visitors. I think it's great, and I know you'll be a great hostess. So again, this book is One French Summer, and the other one is A Month in Provence. So people. Everybody get this book, and I will make sure that I tell people to continue buying this book, these books, and enjoy being with you a little bit.
Thank you. It's really kind of you.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Jillian. Great talking to you.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. She's so sweet. And the books are they're just gentle, sweet books. They take you to France, and you feel like you're there for a little while, just relaxing, taking it easy, enjoying yourself. Oh, gosh. Those were the days. And I'm telling you, people, we have to do something. We should make the French laws about our food, because... when you think about it, I was in the grocery store, and they had this pile of patisserie or whatever they were trying to call it, and right at the cash register, and I thought, oh my gosh, how old is this stuff? And people are buying it. It was gross. We need French rules for bakeries. Anyway. I wanted to mention something. A wonderful thing happened. You know, for you always wonder what is a witch's favorite number. So you probably would think 13. So I think a witch's favorite number is 13. And today, number 13 is my favorite number for Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries, because this new book, Now You See It, is so good. You can pre-order it. It is just a wonderful book. She will be on talking about it when it's released, but you can pre-order it now. It's called Now You See It. And Carol J. Perry has been, she was my first guest in the studio, and I was so thrilled to watch as she's gone through these years. I've been on the air now, I'm in the ninth year, and over these years, she's managed to get up to 13 with Witch City Mysteries, and up to number three with her Haunted Haven Mysteries. But I love Now You See It. My sister, Natalie, is a connoisseur of cozy mysteries. And she got this book and read it. And it, one of the wonderful things about this book is it covers very much Lee Barrett, the main character, is involved in setting up the museum for the history of Salem. And it is just filled with so much fun information about Salem and about the seafaring times in Salem. And the research that Carol must have put into this book is enormous, but it's just, she wrote about it so seamlessly. It's so much part of the story. A wonderful mystery, of course, now that her main character, Lee Barrett, is married. And we waited a long time to get Lee married. But she's happily married to Pete Mondello, who is a detective. And, of course, they're always going to get involved in some crime, and this one is particularly interesting because it is set around an art exhibit, and Carol's descriptions are just perfect. You really have to get this book. It's number 13, Now You See It, by Carol J. Perry. And as I said, my sister says it is just brilliant. Okay, everybody, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, like we are hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries. They would be perfect. Oh, I wish Hallmark would listen to this program and grab Carol books right now, because we need something new. I am tired of all the reruns. Please get some new product. Anyway, everybody, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Thank you for everything. He saluted me. I saluted him because I should have been a general. Oh, goodness, I should have been a general. That's for sure. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye now.